Hello, this is Leslie Garfa-Tenzer, and this is Law to Fact. Today I'm speaking with Professor Nina Cohn about online learning. Today I'm speaking with Nina Cohn, the David M. Levy Professor of Law and Faculty Director of Online Education at Syracuse University School of Law, and this semester, a visiting professor at Yale Law School. We're talking about online education. In this episode, Professor Cohn explains what online education is, what the parameters are for the ABA compliance about online learning, and what the benefits are to online learning. It's a really interesting discussion for both faculty and students. I learned a lot. I didn't even know what asynchronistic meant, but what I think is most valuable is this notion of how to impart online learning and marry it to the traditional Socratic method. It's something that I think you'll find very fascinating and hope you'll enjoy. If you're listening to this, chances are you're about to take the bar exam. If you're interested in taking the bar, you can save $100 by going to Kaplan Test Prep and putting in the code Leslie100. That'll save you $100 on your test prep program. And once again, a reminder, it's always helpful if you like us, give us feedback, and tell us what you do want to hear. In fact, this episode is a viewer response when somebody suggested that I interview Nina Cohn, who actually I know through the Academy and who is just fabulous. I think you really enjoy this discussion. So here's my discussion with Nina Cohn.
I've known you forever. I've watched your career rise, but also a student recommended that I speak to you. So it was fortuitous that we got back together again. And I know that you are running and have been inspirational in creating online education at Syracuse Law School. You're visiting at Yale this year, I know. But I really would love to talk to you about online education. Actually, I'm teaching a course for the first time that has an online education component. So I guess my first question is, what do you think makes for a good online class?
Well, I don't think there's one thing that makes for a good online class, just as there isn't one thing that makes for a good residential class. Right? The modality isn't what determines what makes a good class. But certainly, key to a good online class is a good professor who understands what students need to learn and is able to understand what they are learning. So just as in the residential classroom, it's really critical that the professor be getting feedback on student learning and the students be getting feedback on their own learning. That's critical in the online classroom, too.
So when you say feedback, all right, so I'm teaching sales this semester, and one of the sales UCC. So what I've done for my online class is I've kind of walked the students through each code provision. And then following that, when we meet as a group, we talk about problems, hypotheticals, I should say. And that's kind of been how I've given them feedback on, I mean, it's not feedback, but inspiration about the actual UCC provisions. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Well, it can be. So let me ask you a question for mm-hmm. a moment. Is the class you're teaching online, does it have the online component live, or does it have the online component asynchronous?
Okay, asynchronous is a big word that I don't know what that means.
Self-paced. Are the students doing it on their own?
Yes, it's self-paced. I tape it ahead of time, and basically what I do is I walk through provisions of the code, and then I give them some multiple choice questions to test their knowledge.
Okay, very neat. So, this brings up an issue that's really interesting to me. Which is the assumption, I think, often when we're talking about online education, that that means self-paced, that that means that the professor and the student aren't working together in real time. But, of course, online education can be either self-paced or it can be live. Really, when we're thinking about what is the best way to do online education, I think a preliminary thing we need to be thinking about is, should we be doing it live, or should we be doing it asynchronously, or should we be doing it both ways? And what makes for a good class doesn't just depend on whether it is, online, but also how do we break up the components of the class between perhaps self-paced and live. Now, the way I understand you're doing it is you're having the self-paced components be the online components and the live components be in a residential classroom. At Syracuse, in our JDI program, the way we do that is we have both of those components be online. The self-paced portion is online. It's highly interactive. The students are responding to exercises as they're taking the self-paced part of the course. But also that live portion where they're meeting with the professor, they're engaging in Socratic dialogue, they're responding to what their peers say, that's also happening online.
So that's really interesting. Actually, you know, what's interesting first is that I never could envision having an online Socratic experience. I'm a very Socratic professor, and in fact, I thrive on a Socratic experience more so than a non-Socratic experience. In fact, I lectured for Bar Review, and I really, it was such straight lecture, that was not my comfort zone. I kind of like the interactive more. And I don't know how online can be that interactive. I mean, I can see myself sitting in the middle of a classroom and the give and take and this and that, but how do you make Socratic experiences online?
So there's absolutely no reason that online education can't be just as Socratic as residential class education. So let me tell you a little bit about how my torts class works at Syracuse University in our JDI program. That's our JD Interactive program. It's our online JD program. So the students in that class will do half of their class credits self-paced. They will be taking a course using essentially interactive embedded videos where they'll hear me lecturing or see a scenario online and then respond to it, answer questions, and so forth. I'll review their work, and then they'll come to their live class session. We host that live class session on the Zoom platform. It's a small class, so usually 20 to 30 students. I can see them, and they can see me.
Can they see each other?
And they can see each other. Think of it as Brady Bunch.
I was going to say, it's like the Brady Bunch.
It's okay. Absolutely like the Brady Bunch.
Okay.
And so I can have exactly the kind of dialogue I have in my residential classroom with the online students. I can see them when they raise their hands. I can call on them. I can pay attention to their body language. I can see the student shaking their head. I can see the student looking quizzical. I can see the student getting energized. I can see the student who's not paying attention. And so what's really remarkable about teaching the live online class to me is how consistent it is with how I teach my live residential classrooms. There's really very little difference, except that I have the benefit of a slightly smaller class size.
Mm-hmm. How many students usually do you have?
Well, at this point in time, we're keeping our online live sessions to around 30 students, mm-hmm. And that's deliberate. Mm-hmm. Since our classes are meeting live roughly half the amount of time they would meet live in our residential building, when we keep the live sessions small, that means that our students in the JDI program get roughly the same amount, if not more, interaction with the professor as they would in the residential classroom.
So, you know, it's interesting. I'm thinking of two issues that I have with your, and they're, yeah, they're just totally logistical, stupid issues, but they're issues nonetheless. The first is that I love to walk around, and I find energy in walking around. Not that that's a deal breaker, but I would think it's hard to sit at a desk and impart the kind of excitement about the law that we tend to impart when we're in a live theater experience, you know, live classroom theater. And the other is, for the students, if you are daydreaming or looking away, I mean, I guess this is true in a classroom too. Everyone sees it, but I think you see even that much more clearly if, like, your little Brady Bunch square is there and you're looking elsewhere, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So interesting.
So that's a great question about the energy. It is certainly a concern I had when I started doing this, because I am somebody who will always teach in my residential classroom standing, who likes walking around the room, who likes sometimes teaching from the back of the room and sometimes teaching from the front of the room. And I guess my response to that concern is twofold. One, standing desks are a thing, and so you don't have to be sitting right. just because you're at a computer. And two, what surprised me is I've learned how much of my energy I actually get from the students. I thought I needed to walk around the classroom. And when I'm teaching students who are engaged, and we have a terrific group of students in this program, that gives me the energy. That said, I also drink a lot of caffeine.
So, maybe this isn't fair to ask. It's like asking you to choose your favorite child. But do you have a preference of live to online teaching?
No, I really don't. I mean, I think the best is to combine the two.
All right, when you say combine the two, do you mean that students should take some exclusively online classes and some non-online classes, or that a class is best when it combines partially online, partially not online?
What I actually meant is I think it's helpful for faculties to teach in, for faculty members to teach in both the residential program and the online program. So at Syracuse, our professors who are teaching online are also teaching in the building. And that's consistent with our goal of having one community, one identity, and having faculty know both cohorts of students and students having the same faculty members regardless of whether they're a JDI student or they're a residential student. Now, the question you asked is a slightly different one, and I think it's a really interesting one. And that is, how should we combine residential and online classes or residential and online learning, right? One approach is to say, well, let's have a class where some of your learning happens online. Maybe that's self-paced so that you have more flexibility in your schedule, students. And some of that learning occurs in the residential classroom. My general sense of that is I don't think it makes a tremendous difference whether the live learning is live online or live in a residential classroom. I do think, though, that live absolutely matters. Why? Because what you're doing in a live classroom is you're having a spontaneous dialogue, and that dialogue dynamically evolves. And that mirrors a lot of what happens in a law practice. But in a self-paced classroom, the interaction either does not occur, which is unfortunate. We make sure that the interactive exercises are part of the self-paced classroom, but in some programs, that's not the case. So in the self-paced classroom, either interaction doesn't occur or it's sequential and it's with some delay. Now, that could be advantageous to the student. It gives them a chance for reflection. They can go over an exercise multiple times. But it doesn't give them the opportunity to practice thinking on their feet or responding on their feet. And it may reduce connections between the class mates and the professor. And so I think that's problematic. So I think ideally each online class should have a substantial live component, whether that be residential or not. Now, if you have online classes, then the second question is, look, should there be some residential classes that you take in addition to the online? Or can we imagine a successful law school offering a program where students never, ever come to campus? Now, right now, we don't have any programs like that that are ABA accredited.
Yeah, I was going to say the ABA wouldn't approve that, right?
Well, who knows?
Okay. But now, right now, they don't,
speak for the ABA, but they haven't. So in our program, what we do is we bring students to campus at periodic points during their studies. But rather than having those trips to campus being part of an online class or capstone to an online course, we have tried to figure out, okay, what are those courses that we really want to have all live, or we think there's special value in having them happen residentially. And that's what we've put in those residential intensives. So, for example, students who came in January for residential intensives took a negotiation course. And so typically what we're doing is putting skills courses in those residential intensives. Is that essential? I don't think we know, because we really don't have much research on, you know, teaching lawyering skills online yet, because the ABA's historic approach to limiting distance education, online education, really prevented the emergence of a lot of that research.
Mm-hmm. So if you, I apologize for not being as familiar as I could be with the Syracuse program, but do students apply to Syracuse and they either apply to the residential program or the online program, or is that just that if you are a Syracuse student, you have lots of online options?
So students will apply either to our residential program or to our JD Interactive program, and those are two different tracks. Now, there are some significant commonalities between those tracks. Often they'll be learning from the same professors. They also are using the same career services, the same academic affairs. They're in student organizations together. So there's a lot of interaction between those two cohorts, but you apply separately. Now, starting with the residential students that come in this next cycle in September of 2020, or I should say August of 2020, those students in their 3L year will have an opportunity to take more online courses. At that point, we'll have built out our online program, and our new third year away program will allow those students to, through a combination of externships and online courses, spend their third year off campus.
Got it. All right, I just want to switch to talking about the logistics of this for any faculty or any schools that may want to embrace this. I use Panopto for my online recordings, but that's the asynchronistic, is that correct, what we call them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the asynchronistic type of class. So was there a lot of infrastructure costs assigned to this? Do you have to have a hosting person? And I guess walk us through kind of start to finish if a faculty member wanted to create their own live online experience for their students. How might they do that?
Creating a live online experience is remarkably simple. It involves very little investment. Because the live online course is simply teaching a course live, just like faculty members do every day in bricks and mortar classrooms. And in fact, if your class was entirely live online, you could simply use the same teaching notes you do in the residential classroom. Now, you know, that has the disadvantage that it doesn't encourage you to rethink how you're teaching in the residential classroom.
Right.
I think one of the key benefits, frankly, of online education is it's a forced point of reflection for many faculty members. And when you sit back and you evaluate what you've been doing for the past 5, 10, 20 years, sometimes you realize, oh, yeah, I could do something better here. Or why am I teaching it that way? Is this really what students need to know? Why did I not think to do it this other way? So you lose that opportunity for reflection, perhaps, but teaching live online is almost seamless. Where you need more training, more support, where I think there's more concerns about translating what you've traditionally done into a new modality is when you're moving forward with self-paced courses or a self-paced component.
So, all right, so I want to teach a online live class. Two questions. The first is, what program do I use?
I think the Zoom platform right now works pretty well.
Oh, I use
it's
Zoom.
It's very user-friendly.
Oh.
Yeah.
I use Zoom for podcasting sometimes. Okay.
Right.
And you can get 30 people. You can get 30 people in those little squares?
You can. So what we ask our faculty members to do is to have two screens going all the time. And what that means is we want the faculty member to be able to see all the students all the time and not have something else on a screen blocking the students. And similarly, we recommend that all students have two screens going. And if the student is using an electronic casebook, not my favorite thing, but if they are, then that may really require them to have three screens going.
So one screen's going to be like the PowerPoint and one screen's going to be the professor kind of thing.
One screen's going to be the PowerPoint and one screen's going to be all the people you want to see. As a professor, I always put it on the view where I can see all my students. Some students will choose to put it on a view where they just see the person talking and not everyone else. I discourage that, though. And the reason for that is you can learn a lot from watching your classmates' body language.
Yeah, I agree. And what and you and so the other, I mean, I just actually did my first Zoom conference call. And so I guess the other question is, I'm big about letting students learn orally and letting students learn, you know, verbally. I mean, hearing, either they, you know, they hear or they see. So I write everything down. I mean, how can I have a notebook and write things down if I'm using Zoom?
You can have an electronic whiteboard.
Okay, great. Cool. Okay, that's great. And then my second question is, tell us a little bit about what the ABA requirements are vis-a-vis online learning and how this live online learning factors into that.
So prior to August 2018, the ABA prohibited ABA-accredited law schools from awarding any credit for distance learning courses during a JD student's first year of study and from awarding more than 15 credits for such courses to any JD students. And the only way you could exceed that amount is if you had obtained a variance, which is a discretionary thing to obtain from the ABA. And that's notably what we're working under. We have a variance from the ABA. Then in August of 2018, the ABA changed its rules to allow law schools to permit students to earn up to a third of the credits required for graduation in a distance learning format, including 10 credits during the first third of students' legal education. So that changed things. It allows a lot more distance education. What it doesn't do is the key thing that distance education I think should do, which is make it viable for students to get a high-quality legal education, even if they're not physically able to come to campus. And that new rule change doesn't allow that. It's also interesting in that it doesn't make any distinction between live online courses and self-paced online courses. And so it allows all of that to be asynchronous.
Well, that's interesting. And that's probably just kind of legal education has really not changed from the Langdalian model of legal education. And I have to admit that even from this conversation, I thought online was all asynchronistic. It never occurred to me that it could be live. So there is some rethinking of this. And I think that this conversation, I mean, it's helped me rethink it at least. Just a follow-up question. Isn't there some kind of rule that you can offer X amount of online classes without it counting as an online course?
Yes, that's a great point. So the definition of what is considered a distance education course by the ABA, and as long as it doesn't have more than a third of its content delivered online, then it's not a distance education course.
And online can be asynchronistic or live. They don't discriminate between the two.
They don't. And that begs the question of whether they should, right?
Right.
Because if you think about the radical move here in online education, it's not that, you know, you're seeing people on a screen versus seeing them in a classroom. It's that it includes a move to self-paced education instead of live education, and that it includes a move where that self-paced education could be non-interactive. So I think, as we think about what legal education should look like online, we really need to be thinking about not just is it online or is it not online, but when it's online, what does that look like? And what are the components of a successful online course? considering both, you know, the mix between self-paced and live, and then also the nature of the interactivity in both of those.
Yeah, because here's my issue. Self-paced education, or self-paced online education, at least the self-paced online education I'm doing, is kind of undergrad education. They're just learning principles. They're not learning how to think like a lawyer. So to me, the problem I have with self-paced is the same problem I have with using PowerPoints in first-year law school classes, which I have, because I think that we promote memorization. And memorization is a third of learning how to be, or maybe one-third to the two-thirds of analytical skills. So I do think it's important to require more online live classes if you're going to allow a full online component, because otherwise you're just, you know, you could buy in Emmanuel's and learn all the same stuff.
Now, I will say in defense of self-paced that it does not need to be just memorization. And one thing I found really interesting as I brought my first year torts class online is I realized that I could, even in a self-paced course, mimic the Socratic reasoning experience. So you can break down a lot of what you ask in a Socratic dialogue into different steps. You know, what is the issue here? Select one of the three. What is the strongest argument that can be made? Select. Mm-hmm. How would you critique that? Open-ended answer. Mm-hmm. So as long as you're willing to require your faculty to actively look at what the students are doing and be willing to discuss that with the students, whether that be through written feedback or oral feedback or feedback in a subsequent live classroom, you can do a lot of that Socratic reasoning self-paced. It just takes a substantial investment of time in building a really thoughtful self-paced course and a substantial investment in time and then looking at what the students do in that environment.
Got it. Well, this has been really interesting. Anything else you want to add?
No, I think it's just so much fun to get to talk about these issues. I think online education has a lot of promise in terms of its ability to serve populations who we should be serving as law school, people in rural communities who may not be near a residential program. People with established careers, people who are caring for dependents, whether those be children or older adults. So I think it's terribly exciting, but I do think we need to be very deliberate as we move into this space because the quality of education could be fantastic or it could be quite poor. And I think the kinds of conversations we were having here today, not just about do you do online education, but what does that look like, and how do you have it match students' learning needs is a conversation we need to be having, and I'm really excited that more people are moving beyond the should there be online education to the much more interesting question of why might you want online education, what purpose would it serve, and how would you do it well?
Yeah, and I have two quick responses to that before we end. One is, I'm thinking not only about the cohorts that you mentioned, but prisoners. Prisoners could get online education about the legal system. And another person who was just, released through the Innocence Project just became a lawyer. And we're seeing, you know, a lot of that. There's a movie out about that, and so that's one group. The other point I was going to make is that one of the criticisms of legal education is it hasn't changed in 200 years. And so it seems to me that online education may be the impetus to get us to rethink the way we deliver this education.
Yes, never let a good crisis go to waste or a new technology go to waste. Let's use it to fix what we've known needs fixing for a long time.
Terrific. All right. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me. I really appreciate it. I think this is a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's my discussion with Professor Cohn. Hope you enjoyed it. I certainly learned a lot. And as someone who is now teaching an online class, I'm going to shake it up a little bit and use some of the skill sets that I learned in our discussion. Once again, a reminder, you can save $100 on your Kaplan Bar Prep Test Program by going to kaplantestprep.com and typing in code Leslie100. And as always, we welcome any feedback that you're willing to give us. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.